Good evening and welcome. It's KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear from Ian Dosher, author of William Shakespeare's Star Wars series and Get Thee Back to the Future. We'll hear about his latest, Much Ado About Mean Girls. Emmanuel Rogers speaks with Michael Arntfield. His recent book is Monster City, Murder, Music, and Mayhem in Nashville's Dark Age. On much less of a dark note, Emmanuel also spoke with Vanessa McGrady, author of Rock Needs River, a memoir about a very open adoption, an adoption in which the biological parents drifted in and out of the picture for not the best reasons.
As I was reading through your book, there are so many things that touch on everyone's life in this book as far as relationships go and finding yourself. So, in your book, Rock Needs River, you tell the story of a person who is searching for her place in relation to self and others. How is that search going?
You know, I feel like it's an ongoing search all the time, every day. I am happy to say, though, that I, you know, have become a mother and found my daughter, and that is, you know, the most important love of my life. And, you know, I guess we just keep going every day and looking, figuring out who we are.
Now, will you share with our audience a little bit about who you are? What was your growing up like?
I grew up originally in New York, and I was raised by my father mostly. My parents divorced when I was very young, when I was 5, and we moved to the Pacific Northwest when I was in junior high and most of high school. So I didn't grow up in a married household, so a lot of the book talks about, you know, my stakes and my bad decisions and my struggles in trying to keep a relationship going.
Yeah.
And then ultimately the failure of my very short marriage. I wound up where I should be, and I'm the mom to the person I should be the mother to.
You know, it looks like that in the book. It really does. But I'm curious about something myself here. As you can be very blunt, I am curious, where did your sense of humor come from?
Well, I'm glad you think I have a sense of humor. I don't know if everybody does who reads the book, but, oh, I don't know. I mean, don't you just have to laugh to get through the day?
Yes. And, you know, I thought about that as far as sense of humor. I don't know. That might be a stretch, but the way you put things sometimes, the rest of us can actually, if you're not there, we can laugh about this because we've done a lot of the same things ourselves. It's like, God, I can look back and say, oh, wow, I did that.
I know, you know, and I just feel like, you know, in writing this book, every time that I could, you know, make myself the idiot, I had to, and I did, because it's my book, and I don't regret that at all, and I feel like it's not, certainly not a perfect person, and we have a culture of perfectionism, and this is not part of that. This is, you know, about a lot of mistakes and about some regrets and some social chaos and some things that everybody does, but we don't always talk about it.
Yeah, and you know, I wouldn't classify you as an idiot at this point because idiots continue to do those things and never know that there is a problem. So you actually saw something going on.
Okay. Yeah, you're the, you know, they, I might be the idiot, but I might not know it until, you know, a month from now. So
yeah, but I understand you have a pretty good daughter and some friends who will let you know also. So you're in a good place.
That's true. That's true. You have to surround yourself with people who let you know, don't you? You know,
yes.
You'll never know.
Yes, unless you're running for president, you do. Yes. As you wrote about early relationships, you shared that having a baby would come later. It was not a priority early on. What changed that made for you having a baby something of paramount importance?
You know, I always thought, when I was in my 20s, I always thought, in 2 years, I'll be ready.
Yeah.
And then 2 years would happen, and then I would think, you know, in 2 more years, I'll be ready. And then fast forward to, I was about 30, and I got pregnant. It really made me realize, you know, I do want this, and I do want to be a mom, and I'm very excited for this baby. But I had a late miscarriage, which was very devastating because I didn't even consider the possibility of that. I just felt like, oh, I'm going to have this baby, and I'll be a mom, and then that's going to be the course of my life. And, you know, when I lost the baby, it changed a lot, and it really cemented for me, you know, this is something that I want, and if I'm going to do this, I really need to start pursuing that.
And I am sorry about those events, but I think that from reading your book, you actually made some choices to come around and come out of this very well. I felt like I actually met some of the guys that you were talking about, and I certainly grew up with some of them. Don't know them anymore.
Mm.
But, yeah. Oh, my. Yes. that friendship didn't last long either for me. So, and that was just, he was just a friend. So I think I know some female Vitos also.
I still have great love for the Vito in the book. And, yeah. You know, we still are friends, actually. You know, and I hope that shows as well, that there are just, you love somebody, you kind of always love them.
Yeah, for you, I understand that. For me, it's like I have to get that person away because it's actually a bad influence on my part. So you have to go, Vito, in my life. Vanessa, will you share with our audience where they can find out more about your book and also what you do when not writing books?
Sure. Well, you can go to rockneedsriver.com, and then you can find out, you know, places where I will be reading and signing. You can order an autographed copy. You can get it anywhere books are sold. You can go to Amazon or, you know, any other bookstore. And, of course, please support your independent bookstores as well.
Yes.
And then when I'm not working on the book or the next book, I am a mom. So I do a lot of that, a single mom, 100%. And I also, I write for websites and I write for banks and personal finance and lots of other things as well.
Now, at some point you decided to look into adoption. What had or had not occurred in your life that made adoption a viable option for you?
So, you know, as we touched on, I had some failed pregnancies.
Yes.
And then I kind of came to the point where I was either going to do fertility treatments, which is a, you know, a beautiful option for so many people, and it works so well for so many people. For me, that didn't feel like my path. That didn't feel like the right thing for me to be doing. And so I just really started to look at adoption and what were my options there. And there are a lot. There's international adoption and foster kid adoption and domestic infant adoption, which is what I ultimately chose. I went through an agency in Orange County. And through that agency, I met Bill and Bridget, who are Grace's birth parents.
I'd like to know a little bit more about these two, because they're someone that you actually took in at some point.
They had also connected with the agency when it became apparent that they did not want to become parents and they didn't want to raise a child. So we met them 4 days before Grace was born. It was kind of like being pregnant for 4 days and having to get ready, but also 2 years because I had been in the process for 2 years. So they are musicians, and they, at that point, were living in a very small room in a hotel downtown L.A., and he was working at a Pizza Hut as an assistant manager, and then a couple years in, he had lost his job. So in that time, we had had contact, so we would sometimes meet for play dates, and we would definitely share photos and notes, and we were Facebook friends. And then when they became homeless, you know how L.A. gets that real rainy, cold monsoon season?
Yes.
And it was that on steroids in 2013 when they did become homeless. And so at one point, I just said, do you want to stay? We didn't lay out boundaries or expectations, which is a regret, but they did come stay with us, and Grace got to know them in a different way than she might otherwise.
Why did you decide to say, come on into my home?
You know, if you knew somebody who was on the street mm-hmm. and it was cold and raining, you would probably invite them on your couch as well, at least for a couple nights,
yeah.
Which is how it started. And I think anybody would do that, but I also have this unrepayable debt to them that, you know, they gave me their child, and I'm her mom, and there's no greater miracle for me to have that.
You did say you didn't set any boundaries, but I'm so curious as to what did you hope would happen when you opened your heart and home to these people who had given you this most precious gift?
Okay, so that's a great question. So, you know, in my middle-class girl experience, if I, you know, I approached it like, well, if I were homeless, uh-huh. this is what I would do. You know, I would want to find out how to work at Trader Joe's, or I would want to find out how to take advantage of free medical services. And, you know, so I had this whole idea of what I thought they should be doing.
Yes.
You know, but really, unless you are in that situation, you have a different mindset and you don't know all of the challenges and all of the other barriers there are to someone getting on their feet. Some of it is motivational. Some of it is, you know, when you're homeless, and for Bridget and Bill, being homeless wasn't bottoming out. It was the next step to getting free housing because of the system.
Right.
You know, if you're sleeping on somebody's couch, you're not considered homeless. But really, it is an instability. If you are staying in a shelter, you can't expect to, you know, leave at 7 o'clock the next morning with all of your belongings in a shopping cart. and go show up at, you know, CVS and get a job.
Right.
You know, it's just like there's just so many cracks where it can fall through. So I had different expectations. And then, you know, once I met them and like really upon further reflection, I realized that, you know, their situation was just so much more nuanced and different than I had thought it would be.
Well, your story is such a wonderful story, and there's so much more to it than I'm able to, you know, get from you today. But I am curious, how are all of you doing now today?
Well, I will say that Grace and I are doing great. She is just a lovely person. She is fun and funny and smart and kind, and she is, you know, anything you could ever want in a child or in a human being. I'm doing fine. There is some sad news is that her father, my ex-husband, has died.
Oh, sorry.
And he died about a month ago. So we are trying to figure out, you know, the new normal for that. So it's like I'm 100% single parent now all the time. And then we have not really heard from Bridget and Bill. So they have chosen to not be in contact with us right now. So I, you know, I always hope they are well. And I hope that if Grace ever needs them, they'll be available to her.
Yeah, you know, this has really been my pleasure to read your book, Rock Needs River. And I do wish you and yours as much success as you continue your journey of life's discoveries. But I want to encourage the audience to pick up a copy of this book if they've ever wanted to know about some of the things that you've had to go through with adoption, dealing with birth parents, raising a wonderful child, and going through life. This is a wonderful story. So thank you for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you. You're such a generous interviewer, and I really appreciate our conversation.
I do, too.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Vanessa McGrady, author of Rock Needs River, a memoir about a very open adoption. Once again, more at VanessaMcGrady.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online at KVCRnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, we'll have Emmanuel Rogers once again speaking with Michael Arntfield. His recent book is Monster City, Murder, Music, and Mayhem in Nashville's Dark Age. First, though, imagine a mashup of pop culture and Shakespearean prose. Ian Dosher imagined such a thing a great deal of the time, so much so that his books include quite recently Much Ado About Mean Girls and Get Thee Back to the Future. Also, William Shakespeare's Star Wars series. That's a book for each episode in the movie franchise out so far. We will be speaking, I think, mostly about Much Ado About Mean Girls. A bit about you. The press release has you holding a BA in music from Yale, but then we go to Masters of Divinity from Yale Divinity School, a PhD in theology, Union Seminary. This is the part that really caught me. A theologically trained social media specialist. Before reading your background, I would have guessed you to be a theater geek like myself.
Which I am. Okay. To be fair, I am a big theater geek also.
Okay. I would have almost guessed you to be a priest. Were you heading this way in one point?
I actually am an ordained Presbyterian pastor.
Oh, okay. Gosh, that's what I grew up as well. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there's a certain predestination with Presbyterian doctrine that allows for adaptation of sacred scripture. In this case, we're talking muchly about Shakespeare. Now, we're going to be speaking, you know, of course, much ado about Mean Girls, but it's only with the reception of this book and the press release. You have a lot of these books out there. I'm just learning of the Star Wars series, and we'll be mentioning Get Thee Back to the Future, but I understand you have 10 books out of this kind of thing?
Yes, so 8 Star Wars books, all following along with the different episodes of the Star Wars series so far, and then Back to the Future and Mean Girls.
Being a Star Wars geek as well, did you start with Episode 4, as you should, or did you actually start with 1 and go forward?
No, I did start with 4.
Yes. You couldn't have tackled a full screenplay your first time. What were your first, maybe, experiments with rewriting something as if the bard had said it?
So what happened was that I had the idea for William Shakespeare's Star Wars after rewatching the original trilogy and visiting the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and reading Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which is one of the first popular mashup books.
Yes.
And I wrote to Quirk Books because they're the ones who had published Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and so their editor's email address was there on their website. I explained the idea to him, And he wrote back fairly quickly, and he said, well, you know, that's an interesting idea, and if you write something, let me know, and I'll take a look at it. And so I thought, okay, this is great. A real-life editor will read something if I write it. So I sat down, you know, I had written a little bit of iambic pentameter in the past. I'm the kind of nerd who had written the occasional sonnet here and there, but had never quite to do it in such length. So, but I sat down and wrote basically the first act, so the first fifth of the first book, getting through about 25 minutes of the original Star Wars movie. I sent that off to him, and he liked it, and he wanted to publish it, and so he contacted Lucasfilm, and from there we were sort of off and running. But it was definitely a challenge. I just wasn't sure if it was going to work when I sat down to do it. I didn't know if it was going to make any sense to try to rewrite it as a Shakespeare play. But as I started doing it, I was like, yeah, I think this is working.
I suppose it'd be one thing to recreate a scene that we know well from Star Wars, and of course, I'm speaking of Episode 4 here, one of the classic moments, even the beginning, where Princess Leia is. Can you give us that? The words that we see, you know, that R2-D2 captures on his screen, that they eventually have to sort out and see. Obi-Wan, you're my only hope.
Yeah, of course. So what she actually ends up saying, let's see, I've got it here, it says, oh, help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, help. Thou art mine only hope. Oh, help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, help. Thou art mine only hope.
Have you ever gotten any feedback from Shakespeare purists? I work a lot in music as well as theater, and I really think that purists suck in any form. And so I'm sure that a lot of Shakespeare folk would really love this notion and really would go along with it. It could be performed in their classrooms, which we'll get to in a minute. But have you ever had any feedback like, oh, how dare you?
Not quite that. I would say that the feedback I get from the real purists who give negative feedback, there are certainly people who give positive feedback. The ones who are giving negative feedback, it tends to be like, well, this clearly isn't Shakespeare. And my response is like, yeah, that's true. You know, it's William Shakespeare's Star Wars, and I would never claim to be the genius that Shakespeare was. And so if you were coming to it looking for something that really felt authentically Shakespearean, you know, from a scholar's point of view, then I'm sorry. Then I have failed you.
Okay. Well, just for a matter of note, we happen to be speaking on April 3rd, National Poetry Month, and Shakespeare's Birth and Death Day. Before the Star Wars and before the sonnets, can you think of any pop culture kind of rewritings that you did, even if it was just a paragraph? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, good question. I remember making movies with my friend when he and I were in high school, and we would be sort of riffing on The Godfather or something like that.
Nice.
So that certainly is, I mean, movies are something I have loved and loved deeply for a long time. So yeah, there was always a little bit of that. Nothing quite to the extent of my first foray into Star Wars, but yeah, there were bits and pieces here and there.
The Star Wars thing that really reminds me of the band that got the gig before they had enough material to actually perform the gig, and they got it and then had to write it out really quickly. So we are speaking about Much Ado About Mean Girls. This is the one that I'm holding in my hand. And so I'm wondering why Much Ado. I know Much Ado About Nothing, so this one seems to be the logical choice with all the overhearing and gossiping that goes on within that play. Did I just take your answer for why Much Ado About...
Well, actually, I will confess that the title of Much Ado About Mean Girls is somewhat misleading, because very clearly it suggests a connection to Much Ado About Nothing that it doesn't actually have. With each of these books, we try to think about how can the title of the movie be translated in a way that becomes sort of a fun Shakespearean title. That's how Much Ado About Mean Girls was born, was just that, oh, it'd be sort of fun to call it that. It is not in any way based on Much Ado About Nothing. Now, I will say, though, that one of the things I did with Mean Girls is I took each of the female leads in that movie and paired them with a character from Shakespeare, so that every Shakespearean reference that a particular woman speaks is from the same character, as opposed to mixing it all up. So Janice Ian, who is Katie Heron's friend, she is my Beatrice from Much Ado About Nothing. She sort of has this caustic wit and a sharp tongue and that sort of thing. So there is that at least sliver of a connection.
Perfect, yeah. Well, it could have easily gone, I suppose. I thought about Taming of the Shrew, if we think about Regina's character, but again, Much Ado, it makes sense. This is a very gossipy movie. I do understand that some of these books have been adopted for the classroom and beyond it, well, performing at house parties. I could see you maybe organizing the first one on that. But talk to me about being contacted to use this in a classroom. I'm sure this, I imagine, wasn't your intent initially, but you got a call at some point.
Well, when we first started doing the Star Wars books, I put together educators' guides for those books, because I always say my number one reason for writing these books is just for the comic value. You know, hopefully people enjoy them and sort of laugh their way through them. Mm-hmm. But the second reason right behind that is that I do hope they might help introduce Shakespeare to students or to anybody who isn't unfamiliar with Shakespeare. So I did put together these educators' guides where I'm sort of explaining a lot of what I'm doing. I'm explaining where you can find some of the direct Shakespearean references in my books and that sort of thing. And so when I started hearing from teachers who were using the books in their classrooms, it really is such an honor to me to be part of young people being introduced to Shakespeare and to help sort of form a bridge into Shakespeare where it's not quite as daunting to just open up Hamlet and start reading. You know, at least with my books, you are getting some of his style, some of his language, but it's in the safe context of a movie that you are already familiar with. I do love that they are being used in classrooms, and it really makes me very happy.
Truly, half of the battle in performing Shakespeare is gaining that understanding first. You know, you can't, if you're going to stay with the original words presented, you have to understand them before that can then be hopefully portrayed on stage. What you were talking about, this is something that I had read and actually italicized, that with these, you're trying to give readers something unique and fun. And not only does this add to their experience of the films, with any luck, you're also attracting people to Shakespeare. This is what you just addressed. But how about the other way around that I just mentioned there, that gives people an additional experience of the film? You would have to be aware of the film before enjoying this, or could you enjoy this and go, oh my God, I finally need to see Star Wars? And at my insistence, it's episode 4 first.
Right. I mean, I think you could go that way. I think it's probably certainly not how most people come to these. Although I will say that I have a college professor. I only took one Shakespeare class in college, and that's also happens to be the single professor that I stayed in touch with after college. And I sent him my manuscripts for my first 3 books, and he, you know, reviewed them like he was reviewing a college paper of mine. They came back with red ink and that kind of thing, and he taught me a lot, especially about sort of Elizabethan grammar and how words are supposed to be used. But he's never seen Star Wars. So his first experience with Star Wars has been through my books, and I still don't think he's seen them to this day, but it is sort of funny that that was his first run with them.
Oh my gosh, that is too funny. I do know a couple of people that wear it. I don't really, I just do not understand it. They wear it as a badge of pride that they've never seen any of the Star Wars, and that's shameful. And so this is something that I hope you can get some people back to it. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming live at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Ian Dosher, author of Much Ado About Mean Girls and Get Thee Back to the Future, also William Shakespeare's Star Wars series. More at iandosher.com. That's D-O-E-S-C-H-E-R. Going to Much Ado About Mean Girls, maybe one of the easiest scenes, and please correct me if I'm wrong and give me the proper story behind it, but I would think that one of the easiest scenes to write would be Katie's introduction to the class when we hear about Anthony and all that. One, it's just too funny, but beyond that, I could just see the dialogue in this being easier to adapt into Elizabethan prose. What were some of the more difficult ones? Well, first off, was that one of the easier ones there?
It is easy by virtue of the fact that it's a straightforward scene. It's just sort of dialogue among different characters who are all there on the stage together. Because some of the harder things are, you know, there are so many quick cuts in Mean Girls where characters are having a scene together, but then all of a sudden, like, you switch away and all of a sudden you're seeing homeschooled kids, or you switch away and you're seeing people talk about Regina George or something like that. And so those were the moments when I rewatched the movie in preparation for writing. I was like, I wonder, you know, how am I going to crack that nut? You know, because that's not something you do in theater as much as you can do in film. So I ended up sort of calling on the Elizabethan stage, right? And you've got the balcony in the Elizabethan stage. So I have the main action going on down below, and these other characters sort of enter the balcony quickly and sort of have their one-liner, kind of, and then they go off and the scene below can continue. So that was the way I handled that. But yeah, I mean, certainly when Katie's introduced to her class the first time, it is a very straightforward scene, just in terms of how it would work from a theatrical perspective. I would say that a lot of the challenges that I face often come with figuring out how something is actually might work on the stage.
A great example of that, as you were speaking about that, I think of the scene, I'll set it up for folks who absurdly haven't seen Mean Girls. They're thinking about dating rituals, in essence, and then comparing it to wild animals in the jungles deep in sub-Saharan Africa, and suddenly everybody, Aaron and all the classmates, are transformed into these wild animals at a fountain in the middle of a mall. This, I suppose, would be a great example, because they're just talking about it, and then suddenly we have a flash to that. Can you address this one specifically, then?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that Shakespeare often did when he couldn't show something is have a character describe what they are seeing or have seen, right? So I think about when Gertrude comes in, and you don't see Ophelia die in Hamlet, but
right.
Gertrude comes in and she paints the scene with her words of what happened and how Ophelia killed herself. And so I handled that scene in a very similar way, where Katie Heron is sort of describing, because she breaks the fourth wall all the time. Lindsay Lohan does so much narration of that movie. And so in the play version, she's constantly doing asides to the audience.
Okay.
And so she's there to sort of describing what it is that she is imagining happening as she sees all these teenagers going wild.
Beautiful. This is, again, one. I really think that this is something that people that know Mean Girls and that love Mean Girls would be the ones scooping up this book first. But I also would imagine that anybody who enjoys a script, they're looking for their more intense directing to project, this would be something to jump on. You have official licensing from any of these movies that you're tackling, right?
Yeah, licensing from Universal and Paramount in the case of Back to the Future and Mean Girls. Yep.
I would imagine George Lucas would have just jumped on this. This seems like his kind of humor. I could see him even donating, like, everything to you to use.
I never heard from George directly, but I do think he was part of the approval process back when these books first happened.
I would imagine so. Going to William Shakespeare's Get Thee Back to the Future, then, you have within the script, and this is one that I have not yet had the pleasure to read, but you have in there Easter eggs, that is, hidden moments, I suppose, that would direct folks back to the movie. But more importantly, I think, I have to kind of hear about The Power of Love by Huey Lewis and the News and Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode, both featured in Back to the Future. Can you give us an example of these two tunes so prominently featured in prose?
Sure. So The Power of Love becomes a sonnet, a Shakespearean-style sonnet, 14 lines, that Marty, you know, he sort of bursts into song after he's just been with his girlfriend, Jennifer. And so this is how it goes. The power of love, oh, 'tis a curious thing. It changeth hawks into a gentle dove. It maketh one man weep, another sing. More than a feeling, 'tis the power of love. 'Tis tougher e'en than diamonds, rich like cream. It makes a bad one good, a wrong one right. 'Tis stronger, harder than a wench's dream. The power of love shall keep thee home at night. When first thou feelest it, may make thee sad. When next thou feelest it, may be profound. Yet when thou learnest this, thou shalt be glad. It is this power makes the world go round. 'Tis strong and sudden, sent by heaven above. It may just save thy life, this power of love.
Incredible. More than I was hoping for. Okay, so one of the tunes featured so much in Back to the Future. Now, of course, his incredible modernization, if you will, when Marty is in the 1950s and he gives us Johnny B. Goode. How about some of the lyrics? This is one that most everybody knows.
Sure. Upon a hidden lane in deepest wood was born a child who played as no one could. His genius was pronounced e'en from boyhood. His name was Jonathan Bernardo Goode. How good when Goode begins to play the lute, sing ho, sing hi, sing hey. They took him from his humble neighborhood to play with all the king's court, if he would. By queens his gift was lauded as it should. No one was better, nay, 'twas understood. How good when Goode begins to play the lute, sing ho, sing hi, sing hey. There you go.
Nice. Beautiful, beautiful. How about a website, whether it's a Facebook site or Instagram or your website? People need to know more about these books and find out about the other ones that we're not even addressing right now.
Sure. So I do have a website. It's iandescher.com, and Descher is DOESCHER. And I'm also on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter as Ian Descher also.
All right. Beautiful. Again, now looking at Much Ado About Mean Girls, a lot of wonderful illustrations through and through. There's a painting or a drawing on the cover, but it seems to be in a different stylistic approach than the illustrations through and through. Was this someone provided to you, or did you actually have a hand in picking the person to take care of the illustrations for this?
Yeah, so the way that illustrations work is that QuirkBooks usually sends me a list of proposed illustrations, and then I can suggest others to them or tell them, well, if you're going to do this, then maybe think about tweaking it this way or whatever. And then they have contacted the illustrators. And in this case, for these books, the person who did the interior illustrations for both Mean Girls and Back to the Future is the same person. But then they had different people do the covers for both of them. So three illustrators total then for these two books, as opposed to just one for all of my Star Wars books.
Okay. I just noted, by the way, as you were speaking and I was looking at the illustrations, I see that William Shakespeare's Much Ado About Mean Girls by Ian Desher, but it's inspired by the work of Tina Fey and William Shakespeare. William would be so proud to be in that company of Tina Fey. What do you see as far as some of your next ones, as far as tackling? We've had Star Wars, and in a sense, I suppose you could just be waiting for the next one.
I actually have written Episode 8, and it actually came out last year, so I am all caught up at this point. And the next one that comes out is 9, which comes out in December, and I do assume I will be doing that one as well. Yeah.
Okay. How about some of the Star Wars-associated films that even the purists in that regard, in the Star Wars world, we still embrace, I think, in the sense of what belongs in the canon? There was the wonderful prequel, the one that ends just moments before Episode 4 begins. Do you have any interest or desire or leanings toward tackling some of the Star Wars-associated films?
If Lucasfilm wanted me to, I would be happy to do something like Rogue One. It was such a good movie, or Solo for that matter. And at this point, they kind of call the shots on which ones they want me to do and have had me sort of stick with the main episodes, which is also fine. I mean, every day I'm so grateful and thankful that they have let me do this. And some of their other things also, I'm not super familiar with some of their other offshoots like Clone Wars and things like that, but I hear that they're wonderful. And so, you know, essentially anything that Lucasfilm comes and says, hey, would you like to do this? I'm game.
I would think that Clone Wars would be such a huge, like a Henry IV almost approach, or Henry V, whatever, approach. That could be a fun one, and a difficult one to tackle, I suppose. We mentioned some of the Star Wars books. Do you have other ones that we did not mention beyond Star Wars and Get Thee Back to the Future? And of course, the impetus for this conversation, Much Ado About Mean Girls. What other ones do you have out there that we did not address?
The only other one I've done is one that I self-published really just for fun a few years back. I did a Shakespearean version of A Christmas Carol, mostly because I love A Christmas Carol and just thought it would be fun to do. That does exist out there in the world as something that I did just for fun.
Can we find that one at your website as well?
There's information about it there, yes. It is actually right now only available as an Amazon Kindle download.
Gotcha. Okay. This seems like it would have been a fun one to tackle. I mean, Jacob Marley's soliloquies, that's just screaming for a long Polonius-type speech to the person who's forced to listen to it.
Right, exactly. And I mean, you know, the language translation from Dickens to Shakespeare is not nearly as far as it is from, say, Tina Fey to Shakespeare. but one of the things I tried to do to make it a little bit fun is every character except Scrooge is actually a character from Shakespeare in some way. So Bob Cratchit and his wife, Mrs. Cratchit, are Benedict and Beatrice from Much Ado About Nothing and things like that.
Oh my gosh, that is too cool. Well, I appreciate your time so much on this, and this was a fun thing for me. I hope these continue, and I look forward to our next conversation. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Ian Dosher, author of Much Ado About Mean Girls, Get Thee Back to the Future, also William Shakespeare's Star Wars series. More at iandosher.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Let's go now to Music City, Nashville, but the darker side.
Joining us today is television personality, former police detective, author, and much more, Michael Arntfeld. Michael's here to speak about his new book, Monster City, Murder, Music, and Mayhem in Nashville's Dark Age. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure, Manuel. Thank you.
You are more than welcome. Michael, this is such an interesting book because when I first got the press release, I was under the impression, because of assumptions, that we were talking one or two serial killers. Now, there's actually six listed in this book that it's just an amazing thing. And we'll get to the book in a moment, but first, will you share with our audience who you are and what you currently do?
My name's Professor Michael Arntfeld. I was a cop for almost 16 years in Canada. Then I was actually a visiting professor at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, which is sort of where this book came about. And now I'm a professor back in Canada and produced a couple of true crime shows, written a few true crime books, and travel around and run a cold case group where I try to get students to solve unsolved murders.
Okay, now your true crime shows, where are they seen?
One's currently still in production for Oxygen. One will air in February on Discovery ID.
Okay.
And one is now in syndication internationally called To Catch a Killer. And you can also get the episodes online and I believe on Hulu.
All right. All right. Thank you for that. Now, Michael, what brought you to work in solving crimes and how did you come to work with detectives in Nashville, Tennessee?
It's just always something that's been in my blood. I'm especially interested in cold cases. It's like if you're a history buff and also a crime buff, it's that's where it's at. So, and I also don't like unresolved issues or puzzles. So I don't like people getting away with things. So
right.
Even when I was still a cop in Canada, I was fascinated by cold cases, by old historic unsolved cases. And when you find someone else who is also passionate about that stuff, you instantly click and start discussing cases. And that's what happened when I was living in Nashville in 2016, when I met the main protagonist in the book, Pat Postiglione, who's a retired cold case cop, and we were comparing notes. And I realized on the spot that this guy had probably solved more cold cases single-handedly than any cop still living in America. And in doing that, caught more serial killers, which includes six in the book, but there's actually more that aren't discussed in the book that he also took down.
Oh, wow. Wow. This is amazing because, as I said, you talk about the serial killers in Nashville. Now, this is in Nashville and not just across Tennessee?
All in Nashville. Now, a lot of these guys killed in other states, but that's where they made their mistake, is coming then on their sprees to Music City and entering the orbit of this very elite murder squad that took them down.
Now, this is amazing because you first give the impression that, okay, these guys were coming to Nashville almost as if some kind of moth to a light. I mean, one after the other, one after the other. Is it unusual for one city to have so many serial killers?
In succession like that, yeah, it is unusual. And one of the theories I explore in the book is it was that boom in new country, the new country scene, and it's starting sort of in the late 80s that begins drawing these guys. I mean, the one guy lived in Texas, but he would come to Nashville knowing that there was aspiring artists there with not a lot of money, and he would pretend to be an agent, and he would lure them to hotels and kill them. Another guy went there pretending to be an artist, and he had already killed four people in Texas. And he just used the cover of "I'm here, you know, for my big break," for why he was there. And in reality, he was there to, in that case, massacre entire restaurants full of teenage staff members. So they were drawn to the city as for the same reasons people are drawn there today. The difference is it was a much different city.
He would kill the young staff of the fast food restaurants?
Yes, all of them. So he hit a McDonald's, he hit a seafood place, he hit a Baskin Robbins. He had already massacred a bowling alley full of people in Texas by that point, and someone else ended up on death row for that crime. And all these people are now dead. The guy who took the fall for it ended up dying before they executed him.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's horrible.
These crimes don't just end in Nashville. They affect the whole country. There's not one state that's untouched by the horror that happened during that 25-year period in the book.
That's an amazing thing to me because with the scope of what was happening in Nashville, I don't remember hearing about many of these, if any of them, maybe the truck stop. But how is it that with so many different serial killers, this was not nationally known as it was going on?
That's what I immediately was shocked by when I was hearing these stories. I'd been teaching by that point crime history for a few years and was doing so at Vanderbilt, and I'd never heard of these cases. And even now, or even when I started my research beyond talking to the cops there, I mean, there's almost nothing online about these, and they're so significant as cases, as tragedies, as foundational sort of breakthroughs in forensic science and criminal profiling, and yet they do not seem to have gotten any major media play outside of the state of Tennessee. And no one can explain why.
So you don't have an answer as to whether this was a command decision, something done like the mayor in Jaws, we're just not going to tell people, or to keep people safe, or what?
Yeah, you know what? I went looking for that. That's a great analogy, the Jaws reference, by the way. I went looking for evidence of a suppression, of a conspiracy, maybe the Chamber of Commerce. But, I mean, the Tennessean, which was the daily newspaper, or is the daily newspaper, reported on these. Nashville was one of the first cities to have regular live news cameras in the courtroom. So, I mean, you could watch trials live on TV. They were all on all the local news outlets, every major station affiliate. For whatever reason, they don't seem to have gotten picked up by the Associated Press. They didn't get picked. A lot of these were pre-internet, so I mean, there wasn't a lot of social media talk about them. It just seems to have what happened there sort of stayed there, or ended up in just a vortex.
I'm curious, out of these six that you have listed, which one was the most prolific? Which one got some attention at least?
The most, I guess, in terms of attention would be the fast food killer I just told you about. And okay. That's in part because when he was still at large and they had no idea what they were dealing with, and by that point he had killed at three different restaurants, there was undercover cops posted at nearly every fast food restaurant in case he showed up there next. So the city was sort of under siege at that point. They didn't know where this guy was going to resurface. And sure enough, he figured this out, and he ends up kidnapping two girls from a Baskin-Robbins about an hour outside of town. So he actually moved out of Nashville once he realized the heat was on. So that case became naturally pretty well known. Okay. But the others, I mean, one of these guys, the rest stop killer, was just convicted while the book was being written a few months ago. And even still, he's got bodies all over the U.S. Oh, and he's a long-haul trucker, and he would strike in every city he was in. But even then, not very well known.
Yeah, and I think I heard about him in just glancing news story that really didn't share much about it at the time. So that was really strange to me, because this guy was everywhere.
Yeah, and the strangest thing about that is, and I don't want to give away too much, but one of the things he ended up also convicted of was trying to put a hit on the detectives from Nashville who were onto him.
Oh, wow.
So it takes a very scary turn towards the end of the book where he actually begins going after them.
Yeah, and like you, I don't want to give away too much, because each one of these is like a small story in itself. As much as they are connected, as you put them together, it's like reading one story at a time, six stories in one book, and it's just amazing. At this time, I would like to give you an opportunity to share with our audience where they can find out more about what you do and where you can be reached online.
So my website's michaelarntfield.com. You can message me through there, or you can Google me to get my social media. And there's some information on that site, too, about my next book and about the Cold Case Think Tank that I run here at the university.
Okay.
And the book's available, I think, just about everywhere now. So either Amazon.com or your local bookstore.
All right. Thank you for that. Now, I would like to talk a little bit about Pat Postiglione. This man, he's just an amazing person to me, somebody I guess we had to be blessed with on this earth to have him and such like him. What is it about him that he has this intuition about how to work these cases and find these killers?
It's just that it's intuition, and you can't teach that. And, I mean, his own story is fascinating, is in that, I mean, here's a kid from Queens, New York, goes to Vietnam, he gets discharged in 77, goes back to New York, he starts doing the HVAC systems at the World Trade Center when they were building those. That was his first job back from Nam. He goes to Nashville on vacation and ends up staying and becoming one of the most preeminent cold case investigators in America. And he did that in part because, number one, he was allowed to color outside the lines, as I say. He was given freedom to roam, and that's the real lesson here. Is, and then he becomes the boss himself, and he allows his own detectives to do that. And I think that's the key here, is, you know, treat your investigators the way you want to be treated, and remember who you're working for at the end of the day, which is not the city. You collect your paycheck from the city or from the state or from the county. You're working for the victims and their families, and he never forgot that.
Wow, that's amazing. I have great respect for this guy, and we need more like him. So thank you for introducing us to this gentleman, this detective. Okay, now.
Yeah, we sure do.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, I'm actually glad, too, because you worked with Pat and talked with him, and I assume that you bounced ideas off of him, he bounced ideas off of you. How did your working together come about, and how did you guys do?
I mean, again, when you meet someone who has a passion for this stuff, you instantly click. And, I mean, we could talk about cases, and I would know. I wouldn't even have to ask him, you know, well, did you try this? Did you try? I know he did.
Right.
So when he would bounce a case off of me, you know, I would come at it from maybe sort of an upper tier sort of psychological perspective. I mean, that's part of what I teach. But at the same time, we have the same sort of instincts, I think, for how to investigate these things. And I share his frustration, and in the book ends with some cases that he was never able to solve. And I'm hoping, actually, by including the details in there, that the book, on top of telling the stories of the ones that are solved, will hopefully help solve these other ones that are still haunting him and now also haunting me.
Right. Wow. Now, again, you say these murders took place mainly in Nashville, but they did go across the state. How did that affect the people of Nashville at the time? Was there something that they knew about that... Did they have fear? Were they going about their lives?
Yeah, I mean, certainly a few of these cases, there was fear. Some of them didn't really, for the period, garner a lot of, again, media attention, which is why we don't know about them today. But the book starts off in the winter of 75, and that's where the city's residents begin to recognize something is fundamentally wrong. A girl guide goes missing in one of the nicer neighborhoods near Vanderbilt University around the same time a Vanderbilt student is murdered near the campus. And this was supposed to be, at the time, one of the safer bubbles in the city where you didn't have to worry about things like that. Because the city back then was a much rougher city. It didn't look like the way it does today. So that area was thought to be immune to the crime in some of the other areas. And that was a real wake-up call in that a new era had dawned when, you know, students and 8-year-old girl guides are no longer safe. So there was certainly palpable fear. And around then, the next year, you have a guy who he became known as the Nashville Foot Stomper. His thing was walking around town and wearing combat boots, stomping on the feet of any woman in high heels.
Wow.
So you have this very bizarre predator roaming, stomping on people's feet. You have a serial killer targeting little girls and students. And by that point, people realize, you know, something's gone wrong here. And amidst all this, you have new country. So a lot was going on in, at the time, a pretty small city, and I think people were pretty overwhelmed.
What was the most surprising fact of any of these killers that actually caught your attention about them and their capture?
I think the common theme, and it happens a lot, happens more than people think, but it just goes to show you this is why it's important to keep these cases alive and to keep them in the news and to get people trying to call in, because in almost every case, these killers could not help themselves from talking about their crimes.
Right.
And the longer a case is cold, the more apt they are to tell somebody, bragging about it, confiding in them. Well, with the passage of time, those secrets often, whoever's holding them, are no longer loyal to holding them. And that's why people need reminders. If you know something, say something.
Yes.
Because these people will have told somebody.
All right. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today, Professor. Thank you, Michael Arntfeld, for speaking with us about your book, Monster City.
Thank you.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Michael Arntfeld. More at michaelarntfeld.com. And that wraps up another edition of KBC Arts. Thanks again to Michael Arntfeld, to Ian Dosher, and to Vanessa McGrady. Here at KBCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Sharina Wad, Emmanuel Rogers, Taylor Milliner, and KBCR Director of Operations, Tony Papa. Music beds and themes heard on KBCR is composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KBCR's programs via podcast at kbcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.